Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome very warmly on this wet night to the Lowy Institute's headquarters here on Bligh Street for a very special event at the Lowy Institute on this important day, Remembrance Day. I'm Michael Fullilove. I'm the Executive Director of the Lowy Institute. I see many people in the audience who are friends of the Institute. And tonight it's my pleasure to welcome Richard Flanagan to the Institute. Richard is one of our finest novelists. I've been a keen reader of Richard's for many years. I started with Gould's Book of Fish, which I found beguiling, and I think I've read most of Richard's novels. And I'm a big fan, and I probably started cyberstalking him a couple of years ago, I think, when I got his email address, winkled that out of somebody and sent him an email. Baz Luhrmann, I think, described Richard as the Ernest Hemingway of Australia. Is that correct? In the sense that, did he describe you as such? I think he did describe him as...
Baz has a marvellous gift for hyperbole.
He, in addition to being a novelist, of course, he has written on literature, on the environment, on politics for The New Yorker and The Guardian and many other esteemed journals around the world. He is somebody who has made a great contribution to the protection of the natural environment. In his native Tasmania, as elsewhere, he's received many, many honours and awards that I won't mention. And I think importantly for tonight, he's somebody who's interested in national affairs, is prepared to wade into the national debate, the national conversation. He's interested in Australia's place in the world and the world's influence on Australia. So I went out on a limb and invited Richard, although he's not a foreign policy wonk. I wanted to invite him, especially on a day like Remembrance Day, to talk about his new novel, his highly acclaimed and brilliant novel, The Narrow Road to the Deep North, which has been released in the last month or so, and on some of the themes, I guess, that emerge from that novel, themes about war, its war's role in our national life and our memory, the relationship between fiction and history, and so on. I think Richard was a bit bemused when I sent him the invitation. I think he wondered what the foreign policy wonks would make of him, and I think he suggested mutual bemusement might be the result. But I assured him that foreign policy wonks read literature, and many people who write literature are also interested in foreign policy, so I didn't think the gap would be as great as perhaps Richard feared. So, ladies and gentlemen, can I ask you to welcome Richard Flanagan. I'm going to have a conversation with Richard for 20 minutes or half an hour, and then I'll open it to questions for about the same period, and then I'll invite you all to stick around for an extra glass of wine if our supplies last that long. First of all, Richard, can you tell us a little bit about the book, about why you wrote the book? I know the stakes for you in writing the book were very high. So why did you write the book and what is it about?
Well, the Narrow Road to the Deep North is, in fact, stolen. I think it was Eliot who said, poor artists plagiarise great artists thieve. And I stole the title from one of the most famous works of Japanese literature written by the 17th century haiku poet Basho. And that's rightly regarded as... one of the great works, one of the great achievements, not just of Japanese literature, but of world literature. And I have a great love for Japanese literature. And I wanted to use that title and some of the forms of this high point of Japanese culture to explore one of its great low points, which was the Burma-Thai Death Railway, on which my father was a slave labourer back in 1943. I'd been trying to write this book since about 2001, and I've written it five times. I wrote it as a novel of linked haiku. I wrote it as a haibun, which is the original form of Basho's Narrow Road, that is a sort of travel journal with some poetry in it. I wrote it as a family epic. I wrote it, I was telling Michael, in the first person plural, which is a very unusual form for a novel, which everyone just talks, the narrator speaks as we, which is how the prisoners of war normally talk about themselves. They don't talk about themselves in the individual. They say, we did this and we did that, and these things happened to us. But each of these books, for various reasons, didn't work, and I burnt each one in succession and went on. And
so there won't be director's cuts
emerging later? No. Director's cuts are always a terrible error, and every writer, as they get older, starts burning their old work rather than bequeathing them to archives for good reason. They're rubbish. They're absolute rubbish. Then I realised my father was growing old and frail, and I felt some need that's utterly illogical, I guess, to finish it. And so I returned to it and spent the last 4 years intensively on it. And I guess it's really a book about love written in the shadow of my father's dying. And I in fact finished it on the day he passed away.
Tell me a bit about Dorrigo Evans, the central character, for those who haven't yet had a chance to pick up the book, and of course you can do it immediately afterwards. Tell us a bit about Dorrigo Evans as a character, and who went into Dorrigo Evans?
Well, much has been made that Dorrigo Evans was inspired by Weary Dunlop, who I did have the fortune to meet, and my father was one of that now near mythical group, Dunlop's Thousand. He was in Dunlop's camp on the Death Railway. But it isn't Dunlop, and it isn't Dunlop for several reasons. One is because a novel has to be about invention, it has to be about fantasy. It has to, in the end, to explore the strange truths that haunt every human heart and soul, it has to invent its own reality. It's not Weary Dunlop also, because Weary Dunlop was too extraordinary a character for fiction. He was a man, I was saying to Michael and Mark earlier, who was imprisoned by the Japanese in a hole overnight and was to be beheaded the next day. And he spent the night there practicing reciting Keats' Ode to a Nightingale. A completely ludicrous story that if you wrote it would be dismissed as absurd and ridiculous. He was a man who, in the immediate wake of the surrender of that vast part of the Australian forces in Java and in the chaos, was in a hospital where the Japanese soldiers had run in and started bayoneting all the wounded soldiers, Allied soldiers there. And he literally stood between several Japanese soldiers and the next patient who was to be bayoneted and dared them to bayonet him. Before they bayoneted the prisoner, and he used his rank, which always had a curious power with with the Japanese soldiery as opposed to their officer class, to pull off the extraordinary bluff of getting them to back down. So you can't have those sort of stories in a novel because they seem too implausible, they seem untruthful. I was saying to Michael that really we invent God to explain the miraculous truth of human beings, whereas a novelist has to make do with plausible lies. So my character has something in my father's childhood. He grew up the son of an illiterate railway fettler in a remote country town in Tasmania. He becomes a surgeon and a leader of the prisoners of war in this camp during World War II, and after the war he's celebrated as a hero, but he feels a fraud and a fake for various reasons, because he understands that in the end he had to play the part of being a leader, and he had to pretend to the men there was hope when often he felt none himself. And I was interested how in life we assume roles that others demand of us, even when we feel utterly unequal to them, and I think that particularly happens to people who the group chooses and decrees will be a leader in those moments of particular crisis. So he's a figure composed of many things, but in the end, a writer makes things up. It's a dreadful thing to admit, but particularly at a a place as august as here, but that's what I do. I get up and sit at a table each morning and make it up.
Well, you have more license to make it up than we do. So let me draw you out though on Weary, and I accept and even taking in what you say that Dorrigo is not Weary, but to go back to something we were discussing earlier, what do you think it says about us as a country? Does it say much? Is it significant that of all the different scrapes we've been involved in, he is the character who's probably most often pulled from the rank of Australian soldiers and held up as a hero?
Well, I think it says something very revealing about Australia that 100,000 Australians have died over the last century in the many, many wars we've been involved in. There have been countless acts of heroism, and other societies and cultures generally choose to venerate a warrior or a warrior leader as their great military hero and great national hero. Any history, any society throws up all sorts of extraordinary figures. But what's revealing are the ones we choose to honour. And the one that seems to me, and I would think most Australians, to stand preeminent amongst our military heroes is a man who, as far as I know, never fired a shot in anger, and that's Weary Dunlop. And why that is something that would reward much thought and much more discussion than we can have here tonight.
We were talking before about the it sort of comes out of that answer, about the communal sense that some of the Australian POWs on the death railway had, that they were in it for each other, and that was the only thing that could keep them going. And I'm going to quote a section or a paragraph from the book, and it comes shortly after Darkey Gardner, who's an immensely attractive and interesting character in the book, is killed. And he says, let me quote from the book. "It had been a day to die, you see, not because it was a special day, but because it wasn't. And every day was a day to die now. And the only question that pressed on them as to who might be next had been answered. And the feeling of gratitude that it had been someone else gnawed in their guts, along with the hunger and the fear and the loneliness, until the question returned, refreshed, renewed, undeniable. And the only answer they could make to it was this: they had each other. For them, forever after, there could be no I or me, only we and us." So, to what extent in the research that you did for that book, for this book, was that sense of solidarity and shared self-interest? How important was that for the Australians on the death railway? How different was that from other prisoners on the railway or in similar circumstances?
Well, I grew up with my father's stories, and they were that the English organised on class lines, and that their officer class didn't have to work on the railway while the men went out and just died in the most wretched circumstances. In fact, at the English camp near where Dunlop's 1,000 were, at Hintock, there was the river, the River Quire, in fact, and the English forbade their men to go fishing there. There were some fish that could be got out to supplement their diet, because some of the officers still quite extraordinarily had their angling gear and kept the river as the exclusive property of the officer class. I wondered about these stories, because it always worries me, any story of national character that presumes one national character is superior to another. It's a dangerous and worrying thing. There does seem to be some evidence to support it, and certainly Dunlop's camp was run differently. Dunlop insisted the officers received pay from the Japanese, a pittance, but they received pay. The Japanese treated the officer class very differently than the ordinary soldiers. Dunlop insisted that they pool that money to buy drugs and food on the black market, and he insisted that the officers who weren't expected by the Japanese to go and labour on the railway, that they labour in the camp doing maintenance, working as orderlies for the sick and so on. And that's how the Australian camp there was run. That Australian camp, which has become emblematic of all the Australian camps, but I'm not so sure how much it was, also was different because the Australians who composed it tend to be not urban Australians, and we were even then an urban society, but rural Australians. There were stockmen who'd lived with Aborigines, they were piners from the west coast of Tasmania, they were miners. I'm not sure how typical they were of Australians even in the mid-20th century. Nevertheless, that's their story, and it does seem the case that that's how they behaved. And late last year, when I was finishing the novel, I went to Japan, a trip I didn't want to make, but felt I had to at a certain point, to meet surviving Japanese guards who'd been on the death railway. And although I hadn't been aware of it, because the death railway was a vast project, somewhere between 250,000 and 300,000 slave labourers spread over 400 kilometres. But I was going to meet one guard. I didn't expect any of them to have been where my father had been. But about 5 minutes before I arrived at this taxi office in an outer suburb of Tokyo, I discovered it was, in fact, the man who the Australians knew as the Lizard, who had been the Ivan the Terrible of my father's camp and who'd been sentenced to death for war crimes after the war and had his sentence commuted to life imprisonment. Subsequently, he'd been released in a general amnesty. And the Lizard told me that the Australians were different. They behaved differently, they behaved communally, and that had always struck him and the other Japanese. And so I was intrigued to hear that testimony from a man who had been very much the enemy. So I think this communal sense was strong, and I think it does speak to something that has evolved in our history. I think that it's a strange form of survival, but it speaks to both the best and the worst in us. Tom Uren, who was also one of Dunlop's thousands, said he learnt his socialism under Weary Dunlop. Weary Dunlop said that he lost his socialism at Hintock. So it's not really about politics. It is about something much more profound, much deeper, that exists within every human breast. But we seem to organise our sense of ourselves somewhat differently here.
So you grew up, did your dad tell you stories about the Lizard? Did you hear about the Lizard from your father, or did you hear about him in other research for the book?
No, my father spoke of some of the guards. His stories were generally humorous, but tinged with a great pathos and humanity. But of a handful of guards, three guards in particular, he spoke of with a contempt. And near the end of his life, before I'd met the Lizard, my father was a very gentle man, but he spoke quite violently about the Lizard and said that he'd had these dreams of which he was ashamed, where he bayoneted the Lizard again and again, and they tore his intestines out and wrapped them round his neck. And I can't tell you, I feel slightly ashamed repeating it here, because this is not my father. Mm. This is so far. So this is what people felt about this man. I was somewhat undone meeting him, I must say.
And what were your impressions of him?
He was a gentle and generous old man who I think had some inexplicable shame in him that he wished to exercise. I'm not sure if he entirely felt guilt. I I spoke about in one interview. I asked him to slap me because they used to slap the Australians. It's known as binta. It was the form of punishment in the Japanese army. And he thought this was odd, but after a while he agreed to do it. So we stood up and he slapped me. He had these dry, papery hands of the old. But he still had force. Because I asked him to hit me as hard as he could. And he hit me three times. And then, and this is again where reality is always much more curious and funny, really, and more ridiculous than life. And after he hit me the third time, the whole room seemed to move, as it was, because a 7.3 Richter earthquake had just hit Tokyo, and the whole room shook up and down. And at that point, I realised wherever evil is or was, it wasn't in that room with me and that old man who was at that point very frightened.
Let me move from the personal, very personal, to the national element. It's Remembrance Day today, and I was saying to you earlier that partly because my father was also a veteran of the Second World War, fought in the British Army in Europe shortly after D-Day, and was medevaced out of Europe when he was badly wounded. Partly because of that, and partly because I think the times were different when I was growing up. World War II loomed quite large in the national consciousness. But it does seem that in the last 20 years or so, World War I has really come to dominate our official remembrances of Australia's involvement in wars. Not to the complete exclusion, but nevertheless, it's taken on especially Gallipoli, but I would say World War I more generally has taken on a really prominent role. Do you agree with that? Is that something to be regretted? Is it time that World War II more important as an episode in Australian history than the First World War?
There's at least 22 questions in that, I think, Michael. Firstly, I think the First World War has become this potent force in a new Australian nationalism because of political choices made over the last 30 years. And it begins with Hawke and the Labor Party trying to sponsor a nascent Australian nationalism in the 80s. They put a lot of money and a lot of focus on Gallipoli in particular, as a way of trying to build a new idea of Australian nationalism. Keating takes the opposite point of view when he gets in and says World War II is really the moment where Australia changes.
And his prime ministership coincides with the 50th anniversary of the end of the Pacific War. Yeah. So he has the Australia Remembers program and he visits the Kokoda Trail and kisses the ground and so on.
Yeah. Howard gets in, and Howard, who publicly stated on several times that in his particular form of populism, he very much sought to imitate Hawke, picked up on the Gallipoli celebrations and World War I, both, I think, because it appealed to his own sense of history and nationalism, and also because I think he saw its political appeal. And I think its political appeal lies particularly in the fact that it's a blank narrative, that it's odd that this greatest defeat becomes this sort of triumphal celebration, that this appalling military disaster and tragedy becomes somehow the face of the future. Personally, I don't think it's whether one is the one we should choose or not. It's the questions we choose to ask, but somehow Gallipoli defeats questions. And it defeats debate. But I do think that World War II and stories like that of the Australian prisoners of war under the Japanese are far more revealing stories about us, and in many ways they speak much more to the future than World War I, which really only spoke about, in so many ways, the shackles of our past and the tragic consequences of them, which were extraordinary, 60,000 dead in a nation of 4 million.
But just to play devil's advocate on Gallipoli, I mean, isn't the same communal approach manifested in the slave labourers on the Death Railway, isn't those same instincts on the part of the soldiers in Gallipoli, isn't that part of the reason we celebrate Gallipoli? Isn't that part of the meaning that we find in it, that they looked after each other, that they helped each other despite the incompetence of the alleged incompetence of their generals and so on? Isn't it a story about so-called ordinary men in those circumstances?
Look, I heard some people, I don't think people think of it that way. I heard some young blokes in a pub a few years ago arguing about whether we'd won or not. And one of them said, well, I don't think we'd be celebrating it if we lost. You know, it's attractive. It's attractive. Of course, people find those stories in it. Of course, they're there. But the attraction of it is that of a blood sacrifice. And that's a terrible story. You know, I don't think that's a story that proffers much hope. Of course, there are other stories to find within it which are more uplifting and speak more of the upside of humanity, but that's not really how it's understood generally, I don't think. So I personally think stories like that of the Death Railway are more revealing. It is the sort of strange place where a new sense of Australia and Asia is forged. And it interests me that a lot of the men who came back, much as they were consumed by hatred of all things Japanese, also often became quite Asian. I mean, you go and visit a bloke like Tom Uren, his house looks like an Asian temple. The men often, their attitudes became much more Asian than European in so many ways.
I think it's been a fantastic discussion, so thank you very much for attending, and you can please join me in thanking Richard Flanagan for coming this evening.